Thank you, Padmadaka. Brothers in the Dharma, hope it's all going well for you. Another talk, and then a nice break from talks tomorrow. Nice work period instead. Of skull bearers and goddesses. He tramples the solid posts of reality. He tears off the bonds which encompass him. Kanha frolics, rotting with wine. He enters the lotus lake of Sahaja, the spontaneous, and finds peace. His staff holds firm the power of his channels. His drum unstruck gives forth warlike sounds. Kanha, the skull-bearer, the yogin, has set out to practice. He wanders alone in the city of his body. He smears himself with the ashes of greed, hate and delusion. He takes supreme freedom to be his string of pearls. Kanha has become a skull-bearer. Hey, gypsy girl, your hut is outside the city. You stroke the Brahmin boys and go away. Hey, gypsy girl, I shall join together with you. I, the shameless Kanha, the naked yogin, the skull-bearer. The lotus is one, its petals 64. I climb upon it and dance with the gypsy girl. You are a gypsy girl, I a skull-bearer. For your sake I have put on a garland of bones. The mind spontaneously is full of emptiness. Do not grieve when you lose your body. Tell me how Kanha doesn't exist anymore. Every day he spreads through the cosmos and measures it. The fool is sad when he sees the scene destroyed. Does a breaking wave dry up the ocean? The fool does not see how the world is. He does not see the butter in the milk. Nothing comes or goes in reality. That's the reality that Kanha plays in. So these are some extracts from some Doha verses in Old Bengali. And thereby, they were originally sung by the great Mahasiddha Kanha. Kanha, which just means the black Mahasiddha. And his songs evoke the theme of today's talk, evoke it very vividly, these extracts from these songs. Kanha sings of himself as a skull-bearer, one who goes scantily clad, who has long hair, who wears ornaments of bone, who smears himself with ashes. He carries his staff, his katvanga, his trident, and a skull bowl from which he eats his food. He goes about utterly free, dwelling in particular in the cremation grounds, the charnel grounds in medieval India, lonely places where the dead were left to rot or to be eaten by wild beasts, or if people had any money, they would be burned. Kanha describes the attire and practice of the Kapalika yogin, the skull-bearing ascetic yogin. One of the practices he describes so vividly is meeting and dancing and joining with a gypsy girl. Actually, this is the this particular translator's translation of the term dombi, which is a washer, a girl from the washing class, the washer girl, an outcast girl, in other words. That's his darkening, his wisdom consort. So today we will speak of skull bearers and goddesses. But before looking at them, I want to make some general points. Buddhism, like anything else, doesn't exist in isolation. And Buddhism itself isn't monolithic. Buddhism is a dynamic interplay of all kinds of movements and streams. In particular, it's a dynamic interplay of Buddhists, different kinds of Buddhists. Buddhism exists in relationship, Buddhists exist in relationship to whatever culture they operate in, it operates in. And it's in relationship to other, So it's in relationship to other religious traditions, other cultural traditions, other social and political structures. And its relationship, Buddhism's relationship historically to what has been around it, has been complex. Remember, we're talking about Buddhists in relationship to their world. So it's a very complex and rich relationship. Buddhists always insist that the essential core of its tradition, the Buddha's insight into reality and his description of it, is utterly unique. There's no precedent for it in human history. It's actually borne out if you study the other Indian traditions at the time of the Buddha. Although in eons past, they say, previous Buddhas might have had the same realization as him. They would have had the same realization. But the core of it is unique. There's nothing like it. The Buddha's Bodhi, the Buddha's awakening, is regarded as a completely new thing on the pan-Indian religious scene. And in particular, his description of reality in terms of Pratityasamutpada, in terms of the utter selflessness of all phenomena that are in relationship with one another, a conditioning relationship with one another, that's regarded as utterly unique. This Pratityasamutpada is the thread that runs through the entire and extremely varied Buddhist tradition. And one really cannot understand or appreciate any development in Buddhism without an appreciation of Pratityasamutpada. If you don't get hold of that, you will involve yourself in serious misunderstanding and confusion. But although the Buddha's realization is regarded as unique, there is no doubt that the Buddha absorbed, drew on, used much that was around in his time. Much of the religious tradition of his time he adopted. And much of it, all of it, was taken from the Shramana tradition. That is, the non-Vedic, non-Brahmanical, even anti-Brahmanical wandering traditions. And the tradition, and those wandering traditions would have had an effect on people who weren't themselves wanderers. The Shramana traditions, the Jains, by the way, are Shramanas, the other still existing Shramana tradition. So the tradition of wandering itself, going forth from home into homelessness, dwelling in the forest, is something that the Buddha just took on from the Shramanic tradition of the time. Probably even quite a lot of the meditation practices we regard as distinctively Buddhists were probably around. There is evidence that the Metta Bhavana is a very, very ancient tradition, not a Brahminical tradition. This is very important, something quite different, another strand in Indian culture, Indian society. The mindfulness of breathing was probably a practice that was around. The Buddha used them. Of course, he would have modified them, and Buddhists would have modified these practices in the light of the Buddha's particular insight, in the light of Buddhism's, as it were, philosophical position. So there was much that was taken on and assimilated and transformed and brought into Buddhist practice. It's also true to say that Buddhism also rejected certain elements around it. It has done that throughout its history. The Buddha himself, for example, was highly critical, especially of caste, of sacrifice, and of superstition. It's very interesting. Last week, at the beginning of the retreat, right at the beginning of the retreat, I mentioned that very soon after his enlightenment, the Buddha encounters a Brahmin. A Brahmin comes up to him, and there is a discussion about caste. And the Buddha insists that it's not birth that determines a man's standing, but whether or not you have, as it were, the divine in you through spiritual practice. So immediately, Buddhism is in a social relationship. Social relationship comes up, and it's immediately critical. The Buddha himself completely transformed the doctrine of karma. In Brahminical Vedic religion, karma is actually ritual. It's ritual action, particularly the sacrificial ritual. Karma is therefore also associated with caste duty. You get to heaven by performing the right rituals, the right sacrifices, performed by the right person, and following the duty allotted to you. The Buddha completely rejected this way of talking about karma. He brought his insight into Pratitya Samutpada to bear and said, no, karma is essentially ethical. It's essentially to do with your motivation. Happiness, suffering, and indeed liberation results from your ethical life, from your inner motivation. It's got nothing to do with what caste you belong to, nothing to do with what rituals that are performed and who by. It's to do with your behaviour. This is unprecedented in Indian religious thought. Richard Gombrich has written a very, very good essay on this, pointing out just how revolutionary this insight and critique and transformation of the notion of karma was. Not just a spiritual and religious revolution, but it introduced a profound social revolution. The critique of Vedic sacrifice involved sacrificing animals, for example, conducted by a caste of priests. The Buddha is unequivocal about the centrality of non-harm and non-violence and loving-kindness for effective spiritual life and effective ethical life. It's interesting, on one occasion he's actually asked about the best kind of sacrifice. It seems that people thought that the Buddha would know all about that. And in fact he gives a lengthy allegorization of sacrificial ritual. He said that, well, the real implements for sacrifice are particular aspects of moral practice. The real sacrifice is your inner transformation. It's got nothing to do with, you know, using the right brass instruments or gold instruments and the kind of beings that you sacrifice. It's very interesting that, because he uses the listener's interest and involvement, even emotional investment in sacrifice. He involves, in other words, their imagination. He uses that to speak of the true nature of religious life. He does this with much of Vedic ritual. He's prepared to use the imagery, like bathing in the Ganges. He says, yes, you can bathe, but the real bathing is the bathing of meditation, the bathing of ethical practice, the bathing of insight. That's the real purification. So he uses the imagery, but he divests it of its ignorance and violence and superstition. He gives it an inner meaning, a Buddhist meaning. So in the Buddha's time, there is a kind of complex relationship with the rest of the culture. There is criticism of aspects of the culture. There is also a transformation of aspects of the culture. There's using aspects of the culture. What is, in a way, going on is a bringing together of vision and emotion, even vision and imagination. It's as if the Buddha is trying to harness all the force, all the power of people's emotional roots and the roots of their imagination. Our imagination, our emotions are rooted in our culture, in our time and place. But these are being directed towards the liberating vision of Bodhi, of awakening, rather than perpetuating the round. It can even become an expression of the liberating vision, certain aspects of the behaviour. So this has gone on throughout Buddhist history. There's been a double process of criticism and assimilation. This is a very fine line to walk. It's a kind of knife edge, in fact. And it has to be said that Buddhism has not always been successful in walking it. I mean, it is true that some Buddhists have been completely taken over by Hinduism in some parts of the Buddhist world, or another religion, been completely taken over by the ethnos, the ethnic religion, as it were. And it ceases to be a means to liberation. So there's a middle way to be found. The Siddhas, the world of the Mahasiddhas, which we're concerned with, is no exception to this critique and assimilation. They criticized, they assimilated and transformed. The Siddhas are profoundly Buddhist. Some Buddhists might wonder about that, but they are profoundly Buddhist. When you listen to their songs of realization, it makes it clear that for them, voidness, emptiness of all phenomena, is the ultimate nature of things. By voidness, they don't mean a vacuum, a nihilistic vacuum. They mean a mystery. So they generally speak of sahaja, the simultaneity of appearance and emptiness, which in fact is not so very different, though some would try to make it so, not so very different from Pratitya Samuppada, if you really go into Pratitya Samuppada. Things arise, they pass away. At the same time, the Siddhas drew on the powerful religious culture around them. That's where they came from. They drew on, they used the powerful images that were in their culture and practices that were deep in their consciousness. They were therefore highly effective practitioners and highly effective teachers. Now, one of the areas where we find this combination of critique and assimilation, critique and transformation, is in relation to Shaivism. The Shaivas, the followers of Shiva, were, and they still are, because they're still in India today, you can see your different Shaiva orders, but they were very present in the time of medieval India. Shiva, Maheshvara, as he's known, the Hindu god, the great god, that's what Maheshvara means, the great lord, is that figure in Hinduism most associated with ascetic practice, extreme ascetic practice, dwelling in cremation grounds, violent yoga, meaning hatha yoga, and, you know, I think the way they did yoga was probably rather different from the way it's practiced over here. And they're associated very much with magic and power. Shiva is the destroyer. He destroys the eon. He destroys the world at the end of the eon. He has all sorts of terrifying forms and manifestations. So he's very much associated with power. And the followers of Shiva are very much concerned with the acquisition of power. There's many different groups of Shaivas. One of them is the Kapalikas, those of the skull. They wear bones, they carry a skull bowl, they smear themselves with ashes, they dwell in cremation grounds. And the Kapalikas are very much associated with dark and ugly practices. To gain power, it would be a good idea to go and get the skull of a Brahmin. And if it involved killing a Brahmin, well, that's fine. Get that skull of a Brahmin. And then do the 12-year penance. That's how you gain power. They practice sacrifice, including human sacrifice. Not just to Shiva, but to ferocious, blood-drinking goddesses. So they were also followers of Shakti, the power goddess. As I've said, you still come across followers of Shiva in India, different orders of followers of Shiva. Some of them are really quite heavy characters, quite well known for their anger and violence. A lot of them are very, very doped up on bung. You know, it's said that if you're not a proper follower of Shiva by some of the orders, if you don't, you know, have your chillum on a regular basis, some people might find that rather attractive. There was also a very interesting group of the Kunpata yogis, the split-eared, because at the time of the initiation you get this gash made in your ear, not in a nice kind of medical centre, you know, it's done in the cremation ground, and your ears are slit, and eventually these huge rings are put in your ear. Kunpata means slit-eared, split-eared. They're interesting, the Kunpatas, because they're associated with Goraknath, and Goraknath is regarded as one of the 84 Mahasiddhas. So some people say that they were originally Buddhist, who've become more and more Hindu over the years. The Shaivite orders, as might be expected with traditions associated with power, became very successful in terms of getting patronage from kings. One of the reasons it's thought that Buddhism lost ground in India was because Buddhists couldn't really endorse warfare. They couldn't really endorse, you know, the massacring of other nations. And medieval India was really riven by dispute between different kingdoms. It wasn't one country. It was many different countries. And Buddhists couldn't really support that. But the Shaivite orders didn't mind. No, go and, you know, it's great if the king goes and, you know, smashes everybody up. That's to the greater glory of Mahesh, the Lord of the world. And we find that that there are stories of the Mahasiddhas show us the attitude of Buddhists to the Shaivas. And one of these stories concerns Virupa. Some of you will regard Virupa as an old friend, because you'll remember him from last week. You'll recall his name means ugly or misshapen, because he's really quite portly and lots of rolls of flesh. He was the sitter who stopped the sun so he didn't have to pay his tab at the disreputable tavern, making the king pick up the tab. All highly symbolic, of course. Yes, Virupa is fat and pot-bellied with bulging eyes, bedecked with flower garlands. He wandered around and he had some disciples. One of these was Dombiharuka, who at one time rode out on a pregnant tigress to sort some people out. And another was Kana, whose verses we heard at the beginning of the talk. So the three of them spent some of their time wandering around the different countries of India, following the Sahaja way, the easy, spontaneous way, with Virupa very much the guru. And one day the three of them came to a town, and this town had a really weird atmosphere. There they were, wandering along happily on their free and easy Sahaja way, and they came to this weird town. The town had a really dark vibe, and the people looked at them very strangely. It wasn't a friendly place at all. And our three sitters, I think it was Virupa, who was very good at this sort of thing, discovered that in the town, or near to the town, there was a temple dedicated to the Shakti goddess Chandika. And this Chandika had a voracious appetite. She loved human flesh and blood, warm blood. And the flesh and warm blood of Buddhists, especially great saints, was particularly to her liking. Apparently the followers of Chandika in the area would lead men to the temple under some pretext or other, and then they would impale them through the throat with their trident, killing them, and the trident is a symbol of Shiva. Then they would gather in a circle and offer the flesh and the blood to the goddess, taking some of it themselves as a sacrament. In this way, they would gain power, lordship over the world. The greater the sage's flesh and blood that they took, the greater the power they ingested. So we're not just talking about wafers and, you know, a little drop of sherry. We're talking about real flesh and blood. So our three friends found all this out somehow or other. Virupa was very good at finding things out. And they decided, they were Buddhists, something must be done. This is a serious situation. Something's got to be done. So you can imagine, you know, this portly Virupa and his two thin compadres saying, you know, we've got to do something about this. They didn't run away. So they hatched a plan. Virupa would offer Dombipa and Kanha to the Shaivas. Offer them up. Say, well, yeah, I've got these chaps. You can have them and eat them. Well, what then? Said Dombipa and Kanha, looking rather nervous at the portly Virupa, who was a great guru, but they didn't. He did have a bit of a reputation. You know, he sold that bloke into... Oh, no, it wasn't him. That was another one who sold it. But you know what they're like, these siddhas. They're all the same. Virupa was a great guru, but they didn't like the sound of being offered for sacrifice. So Virupa said, look, just follow my instructions. When we get to the temple, stay outside and practice the yoga of retaining your breath. Just sit outside, holding your breath. Don't breathe out or in, just hold your breath. Doesn't matter how long I'm inside for, you just stay outside holding your breath in meditation. Well, Dombipa and Kanha weren't sure, but Virupa was the guru after all, and you don't argue with the guru, especially somebody like Virupa. So Virupa fixed it all up with one of the Shaiva devotees, And at night, our three friends, one with a great pot belly, one dark and lean, one fair and lean, made their way to the terrible temple of Chandikar. It was a horrible, dark, dirty place on the edge of the town. It had a really weird and poisonous atmosphere. Really dodgy things had gone on in this place. And Dombipur and Karna just sat outside, and they took a long, deep breath, and they just sat staring in meditation without breathing, their eyes popping out of their heads. They're sitting there. Virupa went inside. And the Shaivite yogins were sitting in a circle. They were naked, smeared with ashes, their eyes smouldering, looking really rather bestial. In the lamplight and clouds of incense smoke, clouds and clouds of it, Virupa could see the terrible goddess Chandika dancing on a pig, holding a lion with two of her arms, draped with skulls, with death's heads, and her face black, terrible, faceless. And he saw the trident, the symbol of Shiva, next to the image of Chandika that the yogins worshipped. So in other words, he saw Shiva and Shakti, the cosmic couple. So the Shaivite yogin said, well, where are your friends? Where are they? So Virupa said, well, they're outside. I said, well, bring them in. So Virupa said, well, if you want them, bring them in yourself. Virupa might be playing a trick on these guys, but he wasn't going to be browbeaten by a bunch of Shaivites. Go and get them yourself. So the Shaivites got up. They're very, very irritable. Who was this fatso to boss them around? We might have him as well. But anyway, the flesh of Buddhist yogins was, after all, good and rare stuff. So one of the Shaivites went out to find Dombi and Kanha just sitting motionless, eyes straight ahead, not moving and not breathing. And the Shaivite called out to them and said, come on, inside you. But they didn't move. They were completely immobile. So he went close to them and he began to poke them with his finger, poke their stomachs, poke their bellies, trying to get some movement in them. Kept poking. There was no response. Kept poking. And then out of their mouth, from both their mouths, there came the most disgusting stench. And this noise like a fart. It was really disgusting, bad, terrible bad breath, bad air. Ugh. It smelled like a toilet. And then shit started to come out of their mouths. Bubble, bubble, bloop, bloop, just started to come out. And the Shaivite yogin was horrified and disgusted. This is rotten flesh. We can't offer this. We can't eat this. We've been conned. And he roared back inside to tell his friends, absolutely horrified by this filth. But when he came in, something weird was going on inside the temple. The trident, sacred to Shiva, that was Shiva, was shaking violently. It was all very disturbing. There was a weird atmosphere. Something was going on. And then suddenly, Virupa clapped his hands and the trident exploded into fragments. And the Shaivites were appalled. Their god had been destroyed. But it wasn't over yet. The goddess Chandika began bouncing up and down violently. Up and down she went. And then Virupa, surprisingly agile for a fatso, jumped up onto the altar, placed his palm on top of Chandika's head, and just shrank the image down to a tiny image, grabbed the ear of it, and then just put a little stupa, which magically appeared in his hand, on top of her head. He said, she's Buddhist now. Just a tiny, harmless statue at which the bestial Shaivite yogins fainted with shock and horror. When they came round, they were very upset and subdued. And they said to the three Mahasiddhas who were standing there, you Buddhists are supposed to be the greatest in compassion. Why have you done this to us? And Virupa replied, You must stop making offerings with warm flesh and blood from murdered beings. You've got to pat that in. You cause harm to others, and you're going to bring harm on yourselves. And of course, the yogin saw the truth of it. And there and then went for refuge to the Three Jewels and became Buddhist yogins and gave up their evil ways. So here's a lovely farcical story of the Buddhist sitter's critique of other religious practices of the day. And you notice just a little detail here, they don't mind, this is a bit of a feature in fact of tantric literature, Mahasiddha literature, they don't mind the use of feces, fecal matter, or shit in other words, in these stories. It comes up again in another context. Again, it's to do with a kind of a critique, it's putting it in a mythic context. There's lots of myth from tantric literature of the period to do with Vajrapani, who was a thoroughly Buddhist deity. Vajrapani first turns up in Buddhist literature in the Pali Canon of all places. He's a yaksha, a kind of nature spirit, a benign nature spirit, but very powerful spirit. His name means Vajra in the hand, thunderbolt in the hand. And he's a kind of protector of the Buddha. Once when the Buddha, through an argument, a discussion with somebody, where they reached a point where this chap could only give one answer. If he gave any other answer, it would be a lie. And, you know, he was sitting there, this chap, thinking of saying something else. And the Buddha said, just excuse me a minute, before you say anything, just look above you, because there's Vajrapani. And if you don't say the truth, he's going to split you with his Vajra. You know, because Vajrapani, you know, felt strongly about these kinds of things, speaking the truth. But yes, Vajrapani has always kind of been around from the earliest days. But he started off as a humble sort of nature spirit. But what happens in his development? He turns eventually into a kind of supreme Buddha form, Vajrasattva, Vajradhara. But in tantric literature, he's depicted as often having sort of battles with Shiva. Shiva is seriously fed up when Vajrapani, who's a disciple of the Buddha after all, comes to him and says, come on, you've got to become a Buddhist. And Shiva says, I'm not doing that. And who do you think you are anyway? You're just a yaksha, just a jumped up spirit. And of course, Vajrapani, you know, does him over in a shunyata kind of way. And Shiva becomes a... kind of converted. But there are other stories. One of the funniest, again, this is the scatological point I was bringing out to draw your attention to. We'll get there in the end. One day, one of these stories, Shiva comes along very slyly and he says to Vajrapani, you know, trying to get him to break his Buddhist precepts, you know, be a good idea if you just killed all evildoers. So Vajrapani says, good idea. And he immediately, instantly slaughters all the Hindu gods, Brahma, Vishnu, and all the rest he can find. Boof, gone with his Vajra. And Shiva, you know, you're a Buddhist, you shouldn't have done that, because he's horrified as well. So Vajrapani demonstrates his compassion, that he hasn't done it out of anger, and he revives the Hindu gods by letting loose over them a huge fart. Again, the gods are made an object of farce in Buddhist texts. Now, some people are very, very uneasy about this sort of thing, and I wouldn't recommend that you, you know, you. Maybe we have to suppress this tape, I don't know, because I certainly wouldn't recommend that you. This isn't the sort of conversation you'd bring up with some people, perhaps. Some people are very, very uneasy about this sort of thing. Buddhists shouldn't do that. Buddhists should be tolerant and understanding. And kind and so on. But it has to be said, this is important, in the context of Indian religious life, this is extremely important. Some Hindus, not all, but some Hindus, and when I say some, I mean quite a lot, did, and it still happens, practice sacrifice, even human sacrifice. I mean, in India, when I've lived in India for many years, I mean, It does happen. You can pick up a newspaper and you'll read a report of a child being sacrificed at a temple. I mean, it is investigated and the police do something about it and people do sometimes get arrested. It happens. This goes on. It really does. Perhaps not as much as it used to in medieval Indian times, but it happens. I've been to a Shaiva temple, a very, very old Shaiva temple. We were doing a retreat in the river opposite it, and it was very old, very, very old place. And I went in, and it really had a dreadful atmosphere. I really felt some dodgy stuff had gone on in that place. It had a kind of brutal, bestial, dark sort of atmosphere. Very, very strange vibration indeed. Part of compassionate activity is to challenge this sort of practice, so-called religious practice, which that oppresses the people and that perpetuates ignorance and does harm. And the gods in Hinduism, even if they're not associated with sacrifice, they might be benign to a caste Hindu, but to a so-called outcast, so-called, they're far from benign. They're symbols of slavery and oppression. This is why Dr. Ambedkar, the great leader of modern Indian Buddhists, the great reviver of Buddhism in India, when at the time of his great conversion to Buddhism, the first vows that he kind of added some vows to the going for refuge ceremony, and the first of these were renouncing the old Hindu gods, because they're symbols of oppression. Buddhist friends of mine, very close friends of mine, very lovely, warm, loving and positive men, told me that when they were younger, when they were seeking liberation from caste oppression, they felt moved, they felt overpowered to blaspheme against images of the gods. So they told me they shat on images of the gods that they had in their possession, pissed on them. And as a way of getting freedom. It sounds very drastic, and I know some Buddhists outside of India feel very uneasy about this, about the anger in modern Indian Buddhists that can be there. But I'm afraid that they don't realise, other Buddhists don't realise, that these images, these symbols, are not merely nice cultural sort of icons. They're symbols of oppression. These gods preside over caste, they preside over untouchability, they're used to justify untouchability, they're used to justify blind superstition. So of course, you know, once you realise you're being oppressed by something like that, you want to throw them off and you want to destroy the symbols that cause that oppression. I have to say it is a phase, it's not something that goes on forever. Friends of mine who've done that, they felt that once they'd kind of gone through that, they had to then move on. That if they held on to it, you can just become embittered. But it's a sort of a phase, a completely understandable phase. There is a similar situation, or there was a similar situation, I don't know what it's like now, for ex-Christian Western Buddhists. Many years ago, Sangharakshita, our teacher and founder, wrote a paper called Buddhism and Blasphemy, very controversial article. And he proposed that blasphemy might have a therapeutic effect for those who have been psychologically damaged by Christianity. Blasphemy against God and Jesus and the Bible and so on could be done to break free of guilt, to break free of oppression, and to even break free of seeing the Buddha and Buddhism in Christian terms, which does happen. People can turn the Buddha into God the Father, which he is not at all. Now, he didn't write that article out of hatred. He wrote that article actually out of compassion, because it arose from his actual experience, his experience of meeting many, many ex-Christian Buddhists who felt really oppressed by irrational guilt, who felt so much self-loathing. And a lot of that was to do with their early Christian conditioning. Ex-Catholic friends of mine have told me, these are Buddhist friends, told me that when they were young, they were often told if they misbehaved a bit, you know, when you do that, you're making him suffer, meaning Christ on the cross, or you're driving another nail into his hand. I've heard good friends of mine, people who have very good relations with their parents and so on, but this is what they were told from a young age. Now, you know, so in other words, every misdemeanor of a child, and let's face it, children misbehave, you are contributing to the suffering of Jesus. Had a terrible effect upon them. So that's why he wrote Buddhism and Blasphemy. He felt that blasphemy could be a psychological necessity in some cases. This doesn't apply to everybody. People have different experiences. This is very, very important. Does depend very much on your individual experience. And people's experience will be different. Their experience of Christianity will be different. And I think that personally, if you do feel the need to blaspheme, it's probably best to be done with friends in a kind of private context. Because I don't think it's appropriate to cause unnecessary offence to other people. Having said all that, there is also the aspect of transforming our cultural, even our religious symbols, seeing them, as it were, with Buddhist eyes. I'll stay with our situation just a little longer, stay with Sangharakshita. Sangharakshita isn't just the author of Buddhism and Blasphemy. He's someone steeped in Western culture, a culture profoundly influenced by Christianity. Its art, its literature, its buildings, so many things are profoundly Christian, or were profoundly Christian. And Sangharakshita is a great lover of art and literature. And in the area of art, he loves the old masters of the Renaissance. He loves El Greco. You couldn't have anybody perhaps more Christian than El Greco. So Sangharakshita is also not just the author of Buddhism and Blasphemy, he's the author of The Journey to Il Convento and Saint Jerome Revisited. These are two essays that I don't think people know too well, but I think they are very, very important. And in these essays, he meditates on images from Renaissance Christian painting. In The Journey to Il Convento, he has a look at the angel. But also in that paper, he starts to talk about the image of St. Jerome, the Christian father who translated the Bible into the Vulgate, who is a very important image for Christian Renaissance painters. And so much so did he engage with St. Jerome that he wrote another paper, St. Jerome Revisited. And he sees deeply into the image. He felt that the artists of the Renaissance transcend Christian theology. They paint, they reach a universal archetype, painted in the manner, within the cultural tropes of their time, of their age. So Saint Jerome isn't the translator of the Bible into the Vulgate. He becomes more than that. He becomes the translator, capital T. His Sangharakshita sees St. Jerome as the one who translates from the depths of spiritual experience into ordinary speech, who makes spiritual experience accessible to others. He is also the transformer. It's very interesting. I don't think Sangharakshita realised when he wrote that paper that the image of St. Jerome in his study is used by Durer. There's a very famous engraving by Durer of St. Jerome in his study. And according to one very eminent scholar, this depicts inspired vision. So St. Jerome becomes a bit like the alchemist in his cell, doing the work of transformation. And this particular scholar I'm referring to, Frances A. Yates, she places the image of St. Jerome by Durer, Durer's engraving of St. Jerome, within a kind of alternative spiritual intellectual tradition in the West associated with Kabbalah, Hermeticism and Neoplatonism. So it's interesting that Sangharakshita kind of connects up with that. But he's using, as it were, an apparent Christian image with all the Western image, with all the sort of emotional force and power but he sees in it something deeper. See much of this in Sangharakshita's work. Again, as previous Buddhists, there's critique and transformation, critique and assimilation. We have to go on this personal journey ourselves. And of course, it's not a straightforward journey. I remember when I became a Buddhist, very early on in my Buddhist life, I was brought up a Christian, but very early on in my Buddhist life, I had a very powerful dream where I was in a church overgrown with moss, very, very run down, and God's power was invoked. And it was suddenly there was this incredibly powerful presence. And everybody turned to me, said, "There you are, he does exist." And I said, "Well, I don't care." And I walked out. I took that as a very kind of positive sign. But recently, I went back to an old church that played a part in my youth, a beautiful old Saxon Foundation church under the South Downs at a place called Clayton. And in that church, there are the remains of very, very ancient frescoes. Some say they even have Byzantine influence in them. And the main image is a wonderful Christ in glory. And sitting in that church, in the silence, there was nobody about, this wonderful old church, looking at that image, I felt a very, very strong emotional response. But it was nothing like the response I had when I was a Christian. It's hard to say what it was. I felt I was responding to a certain sort of archetype that had nothing to do with somebody dying for their sins for me, nothing to do with God the Father. It was something else. I still don't know what it was, but it was a very positive response. And I didn't have any fear that somehow I was losing my religion. That's a line from a song. I listened to a lot of organ works by Olivier Messiaen, a French composer who said he wrote his music to embody the dogmas of the Catholic Church. Oh, well, I went and listened to Messiaen's music. I don't hear the dogmas of the Catholic Church. I feel profound images to do with spiritual life and spiritual transformation. It's as if the sounds and the images they evoke are stripped of their psychological and theological effect that they might have for some people. Some of my friends, when they hear me listening to Messiaen, they just get at, they just can't stand it. It just evokes for them Catholic piety, and they don't really know why I'm listening to it, but there you go. So yes, we're on a very interesting journey in the West. We have our Buddhism, but our emotional and cultural roots are somewhere else. And of course, we are in such a kind of fragmented society now. It's not really a Christian society anymore. What is it? I don't know. Simon will tell us. It's a postmodern society, I suppose, with a kind of a plethora of images, world images. But having said that, you know, there are deeper forces as well. There are the old gods who we think have gone, but which amazingly are still there. And they turn up. You don't read about them in books. They turn up. At the end of the summer, my father died, which was a very, obviously, a huge event in my life. And, oh dear. And obviously, it had a very, yes, very, very strong effect on me. I love my father very, very deeply, still do. And I was very involved in, his death. Felt very, very preoccupied for a long, long time. It was strange, the process, because in a way I was glad that he died in a sense, because he was suffering so much. And it was a good death in the end, and it was a positive death. He loved us, we loved him. And he could go well. But afterwards I found that it was very difficult to connect with anything. It was a really weird space I kind of entered, almost like a kind of dream world. That I entered. It was as if I was somewhere else. Talking to my dear friend Arloka, he said it's as if you kind of commune with the dead. And of course it's all taking place on a level which is just not rational at all. So that process you know, was going on. One night, I had the most extraordinary dream. In this dream, the first part of the dream, I was stepping over. I was on a kind of order convention, and there were order members who were just kind of in my way. And it was a shambles, this particular convention, terribly badly organised. It was a mess. And I was getting very frustrated. Anyway, then the scene changed. And I was looking out on a garden in the dark, and I looked down to the bottom of the garden, and I suddenly saw this huge stag. Now, stags have never been a feature, consciously, of my imagery, but there was this huge stag, and he was absolutely magnificent. For some reason, I got it into my head in the dream that this was Padmasambhava. So, though I was nervous, I knew I had to go down the slope of this garden and go and bow to this stag. It was Padmasambhava. So I went to bow, but then, of course, the stag started to walk implacably towards me, and I got absolutely terrified and ran back to the wall of the house, and the stag came closer and closer and turned into a kind of stag man, holding out a sword to my heart, and I was cowering. I was really very, very, very frightened. And I woke up with, you know, my heart pounding and, just my whole being kind of jangling. And I thought, well, that's interesting. As one does. Actually, when I woke up, I wasn't thinking, I didn't know what to do with myself. And I mentioned it in a letter to a friend, and she wrote back and told me all about Kernanos. Kernanos, the horned god, the stag man. And she told me some things about Kernanos that were very, very interesting. That he's the guardian of the green world. His branching antlers symbolise the spreading treetops of the forest. But the thing that really struck me was that Kernanos is said to be, it says, he is the one who comforts and sings the souls of the dead to their rest in the summer lands of the other world. So when she told me that, it kind of fitted into place, why I should have this dream at this time. She also said that, this friend of mine, that he's associated with death and rebirth because he's the master of the wild hunt. He brings about, he's associated with death and rebirth and transformation. And associated with uncorrupted masculine energy. And he's the protector of the land in times of danger, when there's disorder. So, ever since that dream, and I don't know if it was Kernanos or not, but ever since that dream, I felt this very strong response to stags. And I love it when I go up the swamp and see the little Chinese water deer running away. I see them as the sons and daughters of Kernanos, just reminding me of that world. But what I find interesting about it was that this image just turned up. We sometimes have this idea when we talk about imagination, when we talk about the gods and all that sort of thing, that we are in control. I don't think so. They're there, deeply hidden away, and they're important. They're important, and it's important to have a positive relationship with them. But let's get back to medieval India and the Siddhas. So how did they assimilate? What did they do? We've talked about their critique. How did they assimilate? At the beginning, I quoted from Kanha's songs how he wears bones. He talks about taking the garland of bones, how he holds the skull bowl, and how he smears himself with ashes, and how he lives in the cremation ground. So we find here, then, all the accoutrements of the Shaivite Kapalika yogin. But the Buddhist yogin uses these things not as a means of power and lordship and control. These bones and so on are about one thing. They are reminders of the impermanence of all things. They're reminders of the selfless nature of all things, the insubstantial and void nature of all things. So when the Buddhist yogin dwells in the cremation ground and takes the bone ornaments. He's not doing that to gain some kind of power. He's doing it for one reason only, to remind himself of the true nature of things. I said the other night that to be Tud Treng Sao, to have the strength of the Kapala Mala, the rosary of skulls, the strength of the rosary of skulls, it's not literally to do with wearing bone ornaments, though you might do that to remind yourself. The strength comes from dissolving all conceptualization, all mental proliferation, all egoistical concepts. They've all ceased. There's no distinction between self and other. And with that realization, you can truly wear the rosary of skulls, and you can drink the wine, which is actually the deathless nectar from the skull bowl. You can drink, in other words, the great bliss when you put down, when you let go of your grasping mind. Kanha also tells us that the real ashes that you smear yourself with should be the ashes of greed, hatred and delusion, burned up through your meditation. So if we want to take ashes from the fire tomorrow, the day after when they've cooled, just remember that it's the ashes of greed, hatred and delusion. You would have burnt up your confessions, the things you want to have put down, so you could wear a grey mark just to say, just to remind yourself that I've put these things down. So assimilation and transformation is not only to do with the style of practice and the gear that you wear. For the siddhas, it's also associated with images and deities. And in particular, I want to talk here about these goddesses we keep hearing about, the Dakinis. This is a huge subject and time is running on, so I'm going to be very brief. It's interesting, I thought I'd do a whole talk on Dakinis, but they keep being very elusive, which I think is a good sign. The term Dakini is originally from Indian vernacular languages, which is interesting. It's not originally from polished classical Sanskrit. So we're dealing with a figure outside of Brahminical religion again. Originally, Dakinis are not nice. And actually, there are Dakinis who aren't nice. Dakinis are kind of demonesses, ogresses, who inhabit the cremation ground. They're flesh eaters and witch spirits. And apparently they're associated in particular with a woman who's died in pregnancy or childbirth. So women who've died under really horrendous circumstances. So they turn into these blood-drinking, flesh-eating ogresses. This is the old superstition. And apparently they were very fond of battles in medieval India, because there's lots of human flesh to suck at a battle. So we really are reaching into the darkest recesses of Indian popular imagination and village life. And even in the lives of siddhas, Dakinis are not always wisdom goddesses. Sometimes they really are like witches or ogresses who want to beguile the aspirant and then harm him. Kanha, who we've been hearing about, his death is caused in part by an evil Dakini. He's duped, and a supporter of his is duped by an evil Dakini who wants to harm him. It's the only life in the siddhas which has a kind of flaw in it, Kanha, which is reassuring that there is a flawed life. He's still a great guru, but he makes mistakes. Very reassuring that. But be careful. I've heard men in our Buddhist movement who know a little bit about Tantra, not much. They fall in love with somebody, a nice enough young woman, and you find them saying, well, you know, she's a Dakini. I really feel she's a Dakini. Meaning this wonderful person who will take you to Nirvana. In other words, the cosmic couple idea. Well, she may be a Dakini, but she might not be the kind of Dakini you had in mind. She might be a flesh eater. So there's Dakinis and Dakinis. Of course, hold on, this is an equal opportunity talk. If you say Dakini, of course, you know, when people go, she's a Dakini, they're assuming that they're some sort of siddha. I mean, that's the arrogance, isn't it? Oh, she's a Dakini. So, you know them, do you? You're a siddha, are you? Well, you might be nothing other than an evil darker. Evil, the darkers apparently imps who kind of supported the horrible goddess Kali. You might be an evil darker just getting your clutches into someone. So be careful with darkeny talk. The darkener you really want and need is the goddess, who is the expression, the image of the mother of the Buddhas. The mother of the Buddhas, the Jinamata, is Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. It's the perfection of wisdom that gives birth to the Buddhas. It's insight into emptiness and the love that springs from it, the compassion that springs from it. That is how Buddhas are born. So we need the darkener who is Kachari, who is a sky traveller, one who flies across the space of voidness with her love and compassion. She dances in that space, ecstatic in that space. And yes, she wears bone ornaments and she has a flaying knife and all the rest of it, but these are just symbols of her realisation of voidness. She is the expression of Sahaja, the spontaneous. And she brings all the freedom that goes with that realisation of emptiness. So this is why they sometimes use the image of the gypsy girl or the hill woman to talk about the goddess of wisdom, because these are images that are very natural and spontaneous and free. I'm going to talk about the hill woman tomorrow, the day after tomorrow. Somehow or other, the goddesses or the yoginis of the Indian imagination are seen by the siddhas in vision as expressions of sahaja and of wisdom and compassion. They're expressions also of the ungraspable nature of existence. Darkenis, when they crop up, they frequently trip up the yogin. As soon as he grasps and settles down and holds on, a darkeni turns up and destabilizes him. As soon as they think, oh, I'm having a realization, they just whip the cushion out from under his feet. So he's flailing. They're not always beautiful young women either. Sometimes the darkeni comes as an old hag, a crone speaking wisdom. So know your darkeni. Darkenis are frequently beautiful. They're bringers of love. They're bringers of the true love, the dissolution of self and other. They're bringers of Maharaga, great passion, the passion that comes from the realization of voidness, the passion that is all about vivid experience, about the vivid experience that comes when you've removed your egotism. These darkening figures with great passion communicate deadly seriousness of the spiritual life and the great fun of spiritual life. One of my favourite darkenis is Kurukule. Kurukule is associated with passion and fascination. She's a kind of form of Tara. She's thought to be a kind of originally a tribal deity who the Buddhists kind of took up and they saw in a different way. So she's associated with the naturalness of the forests. So she's dancing, this red Kurukule. She has a tiger skin skirt. She has a bow and arrow made of red flowers. She has a hook and a lasso made of red flowers. Her hair is reddish yellow, like dreadlocks and flying backwards. She's adorned with severed heads and bones and wonderful red lotus garlands all over her. She has three eyes glaring out. She carries on her crown Amitabha, who is her guru, who is the Buddha of love. Kurukule is love transformed. She is the great love, and she performs the rite of fascination on the world. She fascinates. She attracts the Buddhas with her beautiful dance. She attracts people with her beautiful flowery arrows and lotuses. She brings people together. She creates the red jewel of Sangha. Kurukule magnetizes. She harmonizes. She brings people into the dance of Sangha. Kurukule is there when our love, our compassion, our joy, our calm, our faith, our devotion, and even our wisdom start to dance with each other, with one another. So Kurukale and all Darkanese dance the dance of love, the dance of Sangha, a beautiful, beguiling dance, which is perhaps a little bit dangerous as well. To conclude, I'm going to read the perfect love poem by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. There is a beautiful snow-peaked mountain with peaceful clouds wrapped round her shoulders. The surrounding air is filled with love and peace. What is going to be is what is. That is love. There is no fear of leaping into the immeasurable space of love. Fall in love? Or are you in love? Such questions cannot be answered, because in this peace of an all-pervading presence, no one is in and no one is falling in. No one is possessed by another. I see a beautiful playground, which some may call heaven. Others may regard it as a trap of hell. But I, Chogyam, don't care. In the playground, beautiful Darkanese are holding hand drums, flutes and bells. Some of them who are dancing hold naked flames, water, a nightingale, or the whole globe of earth with the galaxies around it. These Darkanese may perform their dance of death or birth or sickness. I am still completely intoxicated in love. And with this love I watch them circle. This performance is all-pervading and universal. So the sonorous sound of mantra is heard as a beautiful song from the Darkanese. Among them there is one Darkanese with a single eye and turquoise hair blown gently by the wind. She sends a song of love, and the song goes like this. Hum, hum, hum. If there is no joy of Mahamudra in the form, if there is no joy of Mahamudra in the speech, if there is no joy of Mahamudra in the mind, how would you understand that we Darkanese are the mother, sister, maid and wife? And she shouts with such penetrating voice, saying, come, come, come. Hum, hum, hum. Join the A and Vam circle. Then I knew I must surrender to the dance and join the circle of Darkanese, like the confluence of two rivers, Ech the feminine and Vang the male, meeting in the circle of the dance. Unexpectedly, as I opened myself to love, I was accepted. So there is no questioning, no hesitation. I am completely immersed in the all-powerful, the joyous Darkani Mandala. And here I found unwavering conviction that love is universal. Five chakras of one's body filled with love. Love without question, love without possessions. This loving is the pattern of Mahamudra, universal love. So I dance with the 80 siddhas and 2,000 aspects of Darkanese, and I will dance bearing the burden of the cross. No one has forsaken me. It is such a joyous love dance, my partner and I united. So the clear, peaceful mountain air gently blows the clouds, a beautiful silk scarf wrapped round. The Himalayas with their high snow peaks are dancing, joining my rhythm in the dance, joining with the stillness, the most dignified movement of them all.